We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take these really complex clinical concepts and try to break them down into essential, actionable knowledge.
Mm.
Today, we're focusing on pharmacology fundamentals, and we've specifically tailored this for you, the nursing student who's navigating this, you know, pretty high-stakes world of both over-the-counter and prescription meds.
And the source material for this is it's incredibly comprehensive. It really serves as your foundation for safe practice.
Yeah.
We're going to be covering the absolute core of pharmacodynamics.
How and why a drug works.
Exactly. The how and why. And then pharmacokinetics, what the body actually does to the drug. But, you know, we aren't just stopping at theory.
No, yeah.
We are immediately applying those principles to common, really crucial drug classes you will see every single day. Things from your patient's, you know, seemingly harmless ibuprofen, all the way up to high alert prescriptions like lisinopril.
Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. Our mission today is all about delivering this high-impact knowledge that, I think, transforms you from a technician who just gives a drug into a professional who truly understands it.
Right.
And why is this so critical? It's because so many of our clients, they view over-the-counter medications as, you know, completely safe.
Of course. I can buy it at the gas station. It must be fine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because they're readily available, socially acceptable. But improper use is a huge kind of silent safety concern. And you, the nurse, are the front line in preventing that misuse.
And without that deep knowledge of pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, and all those specific nursing considerations, that safety net, it fails.
It really does.
It's the difference between, say, memorizing a list of side effects and fundamentally knowing why a drug will behave differently in a 75-year-old with renal impairment versus, you know, a 25-year-old athlete.
Yes.
We're really aiming for clinical judgment here, not just rote memorization.
Okay, so that initial distinction, OTC versus prescription, that's kind of where all the complexity begins. What exactly is the regulatory difference? What makes one drug available on a pharmacy shelf and the other locked behind a script?
So the fundamental difference, it's really rooted in the FDA approval pathway, and it's all about safety and oversight.
Mm-hmm.
So OTC medications, over-the-counter, they're defined by FDA approval for use without direct medical oversight. The idea is that the benefit-to-risk ratio is wide enough that the general public can use them safely as long as they, you know, read and follow the labeled instructions.
They have a known low-risk profile if used correctly.
If used correctly.
And what about when we're talking about prescription status?
So these are the medications that require selection and dosing guided by a licensed healthcare provider. And that's usually because they have a narrower therapeutic index, higher inherent risks, maybe a greater potential for abuse or dependence.
Or they just require more individualized tailoring.
Right. Based on diagnostics or, you know, ongoing monitoring, the whole regulatory framework governs both. But that shift from prescription to OTC, they call it switching. That signifies a huge reevaluation of its safety profile for mass unsupervised consumption.
And this is where it gets really interesting for you in clinical practice. The transition to OTC status, it doesn't just eliminate the risk entirely.
Not at all.
It just means the risk is manageable if instructions are followed. But we know clients don't always follow instructions perfectly. Our sources really highlight that the major risks are rooted in the potential for overuse and, I think, even more insidiously, inappropriate usage.
Absolutely. The whole client self-selection process, combined with the sort of cultural belief that if I can buy it at the store, it must be harmless.
Yeah.
It creates some really dangerous scenarios.
I mean,
think about the classic scenario of polypharmacy by accident. A client has a migraine, they take an Excedrin. Then later that day, they take NyQuil for a cold, and then finally Tylenol PM to sleep.
And they have no idea.
They're completely unaware that all three of those products have massive doses of the same active analgesic acetaminophen. They're putting themselves at immediate risk for acute liver toxicity, and they just don't know it.
And that's the insidious nature of it. It's not malicious. It's just a lack of, I guess, pharmacological literacy combined with all these readily available combination products.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you, the nurse, who's often the last person to check in on the patient's full medication regimen.
Well, your responsibilities are, they're vast. You're forming the most necessary safety net. And it all starts with that core responsibility of accurate medication reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand the selection, the dosing, and the potential side effects of every single substance the client is taking, even if they bought it at the convenience store.
So that reconciliation step, it really goes beyond just the five rights of medication administration.
Oh, precisely. The core functions become intense client teaching and recognizing specific contraindications and precautions. You have to apply some really robust clinical judgment when you're providing this medication education.
Like what? What's an example?
Well, helping a client learn about and self-select an OTC, it might involve guiding them towards, say, a second-generation antihistamine to reduce the sedation risk.
Okay.
Or, like in our last example, teaching them how to calculate their total daily acetaminophen intake to make sure they stay below that critical toxicity threshold.
That teaching element is just so paramount because it empowers the patient. It's not just listing dangers, it's asking those open-ended questions like, so what have you taken for your cold symptoms in the last 24 hours?
Exactly. And if you identify an interaction or a potential overdose risk, maybe a client is using ibuprofen every day for chronic joint pain, even though they have uncontrolled hypertension. A critical nursing responsibility is the necessity of notifying the healthcare team about that.
You're connecting the dots.
You are connecting the patient's entire medication landscape, and you're preventing prescribing errors that might happen if the provider only knows about the scheduled prescriptions. You're the advocate and really the final safety check.
Okay, so to manage that entire landscape effectively, we really have to go deeper into the foundational science. Let's start with how we organize and categorize this just massive universe of medications.
Right.
We use the pharmacological class concept, organizing drugs based on their therapeutic actions and their specific physiologic actions.
And at the heart of that whole organization is the mechanism of action, or MOA. The MOA defines how a drug physically or chemically interacts with specific targets in the body like receptors, enzymes, ion channels to produce a clinical effect.
So this is the pharmacodynamic foundation.
This is pharmacodynamics, what the drug does to the body.
Let's focus on those essential receptor interactions.
Yeah.
Because this vocabulary is just non-negotiable for safe practice. I mean, if you understand agonists and antagonists, you understand addiction, pain control, reversal agents, all of it.
It's fundamental.
Yeah.
So an agonist is the classic model. It's a drug that binds to a receptor and causes an enhanced cellular activity or response. It's basically mimicking the body's natural ligand.
Okay, give us an example.
A textbook example is methadone, which is an opioid agonist. It binds very tightly to the mu opioid receptor, and it produces euphoria, pain relief, and it also suppresses withdrawal symptoms by keeping that high level of receptor activation.
And the counteragent.
For blocker.
That would be the antagonist. So this drug binds to the receptor site, but it produces no effect on its own. Instead, it just blocks the natural substance or a separate agonist from binding.
So the result is just nothing.
A blocked cellular activity or the complete prevention of the agonist's effect. Naltrexone is a perfect example. It's used to block the reinforcing effects of alcohol or opioids, making the consumption of those substances, you know, less rewarding.
But there's nuance here, right? Mm. It's not just on and off. There's the partial agonist. The partial agonist is fascinating. It binds to the receptor and it elicits some response, but the resulting cellular activity is explicitly less than what a full agonist would produce, even at maximal dosing.
Hmm.
Think of buprenorphine, which is often used in medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. It provides enough agonism to prevent withdrawal, but not enough full activation to produce that same intensity of euphoria as a full agonist. It's just a safer maintenance option.
But the clinical challenge is that the magnitude of the drug's effect is it's a dynamic equation. It's influenced by the drug's concentration at the receptor site, its affinity.
Which is how strong that chemical attraction is for the receptor.
Right. And its selectivity, which is how specific it is to one receptor type over others, that's what determines the likelihood of off-target side effects.
And understanding affinity is so key. I mean, a high-affinity antagonist like naloxone can rapidly knock a full agonist like fentanyl right off the mu receptor, even if the agonist is present in a high concentration, just because of its exceptionally high binding strength.
So moving from those microscopic dynamics to the clinical reality, we need to talk about official versus practical use of medications. therapeutic use or indications for use. Those are the conditions for which the drug has been formally approved and tested by the FDA.
Right.
But nursing practice frequently involves off-label use.
Mm-hmm. Off-label use is when a provider prescribes a drug for a condition or a population for which it has not officially received FDA approval. The critical difference here isn't legality. It's often legal and totally necessary, but it's the data certainty.
The data certainty.
Yeah. FDA approved uses are backed by this rigorous data on safety, efficacy, dosage curves across thousands of patients. Off-label use, it might be supported by emerging clinical evidence, but it often lacks that exhaustive, established safety profile in the new context.
Which means our monitoring for potential risks and adverse effects needs to be, exponentially more cautious during off-label use.
Exactly. The beta defining that therapeutic index is just less defined for that particular application.
Right.
And this whole context just emphasizes the importance of identifying common adverse effects, side effects, and potential risks associated with all medications. The deeper your understanding of the drug's dynamics, the better you can predict these risks, especially when you're operating outside the approved indications.
And to really appreciate the safety parameters that we rely on, we should probably briefly detail the intense scrutiny medications go through during development.
Right.
The development pipeline is incredibly long. We're talking about a 10 to 15 year timeline.
It's a marathon. It starts with drug discovery, moves into preclinical research, which is testing on animals or cell lines, and then it hits the rigorous gauntlet of clinical trials. This process isn't just scientific. It is the foundation of the safety data you, as a nurse, rely on every day.
Okay, so phase one, that focuses purely on safety.
Right.
In a small group of healthy volunteers.
Yep. They're trying to determine the highest dose that can be safely administered and just observing the basic kinetic profile.
Then phase two moves to patients who actually have the condition, and it focuses on efficacy and dosing.
Right. Does the drug actually work? What doses seem to provide the best balance of therapeutic effect versus side effects?
And then phase three is the huge one, the massive comparative study.
The big one. Large-scale trials comparing the new drug against the current standard of care or a placebo. And this phase is so crucial because it identifies rare adverse effects that might only show up in large populations. And it solidifies the true therapeutic range index and defines risks for specific subpopulations, like those with comorbidities.
And if a drug successfully clears all those hurdles.
If it demonstrates safety, efficacy, and superiority or equivalence to existing treatments, then it moves to the FDA drug review and approval process, which is managed by the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, or CDER.
Understanding that timeline should really instill a profound respect for that official FDA approval stamp.
Mm-hmm. And it reinforces why we have to be so vigilant when medications are used outside of those parameters.
Okay, so now we switch perspectives completely. If pharmacodynamics is what the drug does to the body, pharmacokinetics, or PK, is what the body does to the drug.
Right.
And this involved the four fundamental processors, often just called by the acronym ADME, absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion. These four steps dictate pretty much everything about a drug's efficacy and safety profile.
And these processes directly dictate the drug's journey and, critically, its therapeutic effect. When you look at a concentration time curve, you can actually visualize this journey. For the drug to have any clinical utility, it has to first reach the minimal effect concentration.
Okay.
The concentration then peaks at the peak level, and your constant goal in nursing practice is to keep that concentration within the therapeutic range index, safely above the minimal effect, and most critically, way below the toxic level.
And two concepts that are deeply tied to the duration of action are half-life and bioavailability. Half-life is the time required for the amount of drug in the body to decrease by 50%.
Mm-hmm. And that value directly dictates dosing frequency. A drug with a short half-life needs more frequent dosing. Simple as that.
And bioavailability. That's the percentage of the administered drug that actually reaches systemic circulation unchanged and can produce an effect.
Which is why the route of administration matters so, so much. If you administer a drug intravenously, the bioavailability is 100%.
It's all there.
It's all there. But if you give it orally, it might only be 30%, and it's heavily influenced by factors we're about to get into.
And this brings us to that astonishing variability we see in clients. Why? Two patients can get the same dose and have wildly different outcomes. Let's start with metabolism, which is primarily handled by the liver.
The liver contains these key enzyme systems, primarily the cytochrome P450 or CYP enzymes, and they modify the drug structure, usually making them more water-soluble for easier excretion.
Right.
But when we talk about oral medications, we have to deeply understand the first pass metabolism. This is a major, major factor in reducing bioavailability for orally administered drugs.
No, let's trace that pathway.
So the oral drug is swallowed. It's absorbed from the GI tract into the blood. That blood doesn't go straight into systemic circulation. Instead, it's funneled directly to the liver via the hepatic portal system.
Mm-hmm.
The liver then acts like this highly effective toll booth. Before the drug ever enters the systemic circulation, it is metabolized by these hepatic enzymes.
So a huge piece of it gets taken out.
A huge piece. If a drug has extensive first pass metabolism, meaning the liver metabolizes a high percentage of it on that first pass, its oral dose has to be drastically higher than an intravenous dose to achieve the same systemic concentration.
So if a client has impaired liver function, they might bypass that toll booth effect, which could lead to potentially toxic systemic concentrations from just the standard oral dose.
Exactly. Which highlights the critical factors influencing metabolism.
Which are?
First, genetics. Individuals can be rapid metabolizers or poor metabolizers based on genetic polymorphisms in their CYP enzymes. This is why standard dosing can be ineffective or toxic for certain populations. Second, the age of the client is vital. Infants and the elderly often have reduced liver function. Third, existing hepatic and renal function has to be assessed. And finally, the concurrent use of medications is a massive factor.
How so?
Because one drug can inhibit or induce the enzymes responsible for another drug's metabolism, and that can alter the second drug's effect dramatically.
Wow. Okay, this depth of understanding is just so key to clinical safety. Now, moving to distribution, this is how the drug gets from the systemic circulation out to the tissue targets. This phase, it's not uniform, right? It involves a lot of components.
Right. It involves plasma protein, primarily albumin, the actual active free drug, red blood cells, RBCs, and plasma water.
And what's fascinating here is the role of protein binding.
Oh, it's so important. If a drug is highly protein bound, let's say 95%, that means only 5% is free drug available to bind to receptors and produce a therapeutic effect.
So if you give two highly protein bound drugs together,
they compete. They compete for binding sites on the albumin, and they can potentially displace one another. This displacement can dramatically and often dangerously increase the concentration of the free drug in circulation, leading to sudden toxicity, even if the total dose hasn't changed.
And for the elderly patient, distribution changes drastically just due to age-related body composition.
Mm.
They typically have a lower ratio of total body water and higher ratio of body fat.
Precisely. So water-soluble drugs might become overly concentrated in less total body water, which increases their peak levels.
Mm.
Conversely, fat-soluble drugs might get stored longer in that increased body fat, which prolongs their half-life and duration of action.
These kinetic changes in the geriatric patient alone justify lower starting doses and closer monitoring.
Absolutely.
So finally, we arrive at excretion, the process of eliminating the drug or its metabolites from the body, primarily through the kidneys.
Mm-hmm. The kidneys' role in the nephron involves three key processes. Glomerular filtration, which is filtering small, free drug molecules, followed by reabsorption, often of lipid-soluble drugs, back into the blood.
Right. And finally, secretion, which is the active transport of non-lipid-soluble drugs into the tubule for elimination.
So the factors affecting excretion are just paramount in nursing care, because renal failure is so common.
It is. And most importantly, you have to monitor the client's renal function using tests like BUN, creatinine, and monitoring total urine output. If renal function declines, the drug just stays in the body longer, increasing the risk of accumulation and toxicity.
Okay.
Additionally, the pH of the urine can influence excretion through a principle called ion trapping. If we make the urine more alkaline, we can ionize acidic drugs, making them less lipid-soluble and less likely to be reabsorbed, which speeds up their excretion.
That's a subtle but really powerful clinical tool. And naturally, medication interactions can alter renal blood flow or affect those tubular transport systems, further complicating excretion rates. And these concepts of pharmacokinetics and dynamics, they're not just theoretical. They explain phenomena we see every single day in chronic medication use and substance abuse, like tolerance and withdrawal.
So on the dynamic side, tolerance is a key physiological response to chronic exposure. When there's high-level persistent exposure, like with opiate molecules, the cells can respond by undergoing receptor downregulation.
They literally internalize or decrease the number of receptors available on the cell surface.
So this physiological adaptation means the drug's effect is diminished, and you need higher doses to achieve that same initial response.
Exactly. The patient isn't lying about their pain. Their body has genuinely adapted at a cellular level.
And if you remove that drug abruptly, after the body has developed this adaptation and dependence,
that leads directly to withdrawal. It's the predictable physiological response that occurs when the substance the body has adapted to, whether it's an opioid, alcohol, or even certain antihypertensives, is suddenly removed. Recognizing the signs and symptoms of withdrawal is a high-priority nursing skill.
Let's shift our focus to interactions, where one substance completely changes the actions of another. Our sources clearly identify that combining substances can result in three major outcomes. It can decrease the action of the drug,
which is therapeutic failure.
Right. It can increase the action of the drug,
leading to potential toxicity,
or it can cause entirely new adverse effects.
And we can categorize these interactions logically. First, you have drug-drug interactions, which happen between medications from the same class, giving you additive effects, or different classes, and these often alter pharmacokinetics.
Like one drug inducing the CYP enzyme, speeding up the metabolism of a second drug.
Exactly. Or they alter pharmacodynamics, like two different drugs that both cause CNS depression are combined, leading to dangerous synergistic sedation.
Then there are drug-food interactions. I think this is often really downplayed in patient teaching, but certain foods can drastically change absorption or metabolism, which impacts the therapeutic outcome.
Oh, they absolutely can. The classic example is the interaction between warfarin, a common anticoagulant, and foods high in vitamin K, like kale or spinach.
Mm.
Vitamin K is essential for clotting factor synthesis, so consuming too much of it counteracts the action of the warfarin, decreasing its effectiveness and increasing the risk of clotting.
And another high-yield example for the nursing student is grapefruit juice, right?
Yes. It contains compounds that inhibit specific CYP enzymes in the gut, which can increase the blood concentration of certain statins or calcium channel blockers to dangerously high levels.
But wait, a lot of providers tell patients to take their thyroid medication, levothyroxine, first thing in the morning with coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that sort of fly in the face of what we know about drug-food interactions, given coffee's acidity and potential to impair absorption?
That's a great question, and it really highlights the tension between textbook rules and clinical compromise. While it's true that coffee and certain other foods, like calcium supplements, can decrease levothyroxine absorption, the clinical priority is often maximizing consistency.
Consistency.
Yeah. If the patient is guaranteed to have coffee every single morning at 7 a.m., taking the pill consistently with the coffee often provides a more reliable steady state level than trying to enforce a rule that they take it with pure water 60 minutes before breakfast, which they may fail to comply with.
So the dose is just adjusted to account for that consistent reduction.
The dose is just adjusted to account for that consistent reduction in absorption. It's about meeting the patient where they are.
That is true clinical judgment. Understanding the principle, but adapting it for patient reality.
And the final interaction type is the medication-condition interaction. This is where a client's pre-existing medical condition affects the drug's action and safety profile.
So taking a beta blocker when you have uncontrolled asthma.
That's a dynamic contraindication. The drug could precipitate bronchospasm. Or taking an NSAID when you have chronic kidney disease is a kinetic contraindication, impairing excretion and increasing your toxicity risk.
So focusing on safety, let's define adverse effects, or AEs. These are unintended and often undesirable responses that happen at normal therapeutic doses.
Right. And AEs range across various levels of severity, from mild self-limiting side effects like dry mouth with an antihistamine to rare life-threatening reactions like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or angioedema.
And the level of severity dictates the necessary action taken in response, which is a core nursing responsibility.
Absolutely. We have to categorize AEs by frequency and severity. A common, manageable side effect might just warrant patient education or a simple dose adjustment. But a rare, life-threatening adverse reaction that requires immediate discontinuation, emergency stabilization, and rapid communication to the entire healthcare team.
And the nurse plays this indispensable role in predicting and minimizing AEs.
You have to. If you know a drug causes orthostatic hypotension, you predict a fall risk, and you minimize that AE by teaching the patient, rise slowly, dangle your feet, call before you get out of bed. If you know a drug causes hepatic toxicity, you minimize the AE by making sure the patient is not drinking alcohol.
And that leads directly to our final point in this section, the high priority of monitoring parameters. It starts with ongoing clinical monitoring for assessment changes. Is the medication effective?
Is it working? For an opioid, is the pain scale score decreasing? For a diuretic, is the patient's fluid status improving, and are their edema levels reducing?
And then there's laboratory monitoring.
Mm-hmm. The purpose here is twofold: ensuring therapeutic effectiveness and minimizing adverse effects. Common tests are liver enzymes, AST and ALT, to check for hepatotoxicity, and renal function tests, BUN and creatinine, to check for excretion issues.
And we're often looking for drug levels that fall within the therapeutic range index.
That's always.
So what happens when results are outside that therapeutic range?
This is a critical action point for you as the nurse. If the level is too low, the client's at risk of treatment failure. You assess their adherence, you notify the provider to discuss a dose increase.
And if it's too high?
If the level is too high above the toxic level, you have an emergency on your hands. The steps are usually immediate. Hold the dose, assess the patient for symptomatic changes. Are they confused? Are they showing signs of toxicity? Notify the provider using a structured tool like SBR, and often require urgent lab follow-up to confirm the result. This immediate application of lab values is where your knowledge truly, truly shines.
Okay, now we get to apply all that theory directly to the medications you're going to encounter every single day. Let's start with the most common OTCs, pain relievers and fever reducers, the analgesics and antipyretics.
This is where we see pharmacokinetics and nursing considerations just intersecting constantly.
Let's start with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NADs, with common OTC examples like ibuprofen, naproxen, and aspirin.
Their uses cover mild to moderate pain, inflammation reduction, and fever. And aspirin is kind of unique among them, also used at low doses for its antiplatelet effect.
Okay, let's delve deeper into their dynamics, their MOA. How do they actually reduce inflammation and pain?
So their key dynamic is the inhibition of the cyclooxygenase, or COX, enzymes. There are two main types, COX1 and COX2. Oh. These enzymes convert arachidonic acid into prostaglandins and thromboxanes. COX1 is generally the protective enzyme. It maintains your GI mucosal lining and supports renal blood flow. COX2 is primarily induced at sites of inflammation.
So by inhibiting these enzymes, NSAIDs reduce prostaglandin synthesis.
Exactly. And this achieves three results: reduced inflammation, decreased sensitization of peripheral pain receptors, and a lowering of the hypothalamic temperature set point.
And so what's the risk here? If they inhibit COX1, they're compromising that protective GI lining.
That's the problem. The non-selective NSAIDs, like ibuprofen and aspirin, they inhibit both. And that leads to reduced gastric protection, increased acid secretion, and decreased platelet aggregation. Hence the risk of GI irritation and bleeding.
And that risk increases exponentially with dose and duration.
It does. Kinetically, most NSAIDs are well absorbed orally. They're highly protein bound, meaning they're competing for those albumin sites. They're extensively metabolized in the liver, often by CYP enzymes, and primarily excreted through the kidneys.
Which you mean?
Because of this hepatic and renal route, reduced function in either organ can significantly prolong the drug effects and increase toxicity.
So this leads us to the crucial nursing considerations for NSAIDs. What are the critical student takeaways you have to enforce?
First, because of their GI effects, always give NSAIDs with food or milk to reduce that direct mucosal irritation. Second, you must monitor for signs of GI bleeding. That means asking about symptoms like heartburn or epigastric pain, and clinically assessing for coffee ground emesis, or crucially, black Terry stools melina.
We also have to address the renal caution.
Absolutely essential. NSAIDs can be nephrotoxic, especially in already compromised kidneys, because they inhibit the prostaglandins needed to maintain renal blood flow.
So you have to rigorously monitor renal function.
Rigorously. BUN, creatinine, tracking urine output. You have to use extreme caution in the elderly, chronic kidney disease patients, and those with volume depletion, heart failure, or hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important. Never allow the patient to combine multiple NSAIDs because of the additive GI and renal risks.
Mm-hmm.
And always advise clients to avoid use in the third trimester of pregnancy, as it can prematurely close the ductus arteriosus in the fetus.
That sets up a perfect comparison with acetaminophen or Tylenol. This is a non-opioid analgesic and antipyretic, but critically, it is not an NSAI.
Not an NSAI. It lacks peripheral anti-inflammatory and antiplatelet effects.
And that unique profile makes it the preferred choice for clients with existing GI ulcers, bleeding risk, or kidney disease.
It does. Dynamically, acetaminophen inhibits prostaglandin synthesis, but primarily in the central nervous system, and it acts on the hypothalamic heat-regulating center. Kinetically, it's rapidly absorbed and metabolized in the liver.
And this metabolism is the source of its danger.
It is. Most of the drug is harmlessly metabolized. but a small amount becomes this highly toxic metabolite called NAPQI, which is normally detoxified by the liver supply of glutathione.
So when the glutathione stores are depleted, like in an overdose or with chronic misuse, the NAPQI accumulates and causes irreversible hepatic necrosis.
Yep. The key adverse effect is severe dose-related hepatotoxicity and subsequent liver failure.
So the NCCs here are laser-focused on safe dosing and liver function.
Meticulously. You have to assess the total daily dose from all sources because it hides in so many combination medications, cold and flu remedies, pain relievers with caffeine, sleep aids.
All of them.
All of them. The official max dosing is typically 4,000 milligrams per day for healthy adults, but you have to teach the patient that this is lowered to less than or equal to 2,000 milligrams per day in clients with liver disease, chronic malnutrition, or chronic alcohol use.
Because of their depleted glutathione stores.
Exactly. You have to monitor liver enzymes like AST and ALT with prolonged use and explicitly teach patients to avoid alcohol while taking it.
Now let's transition to a powerful prescription pain reliever, oxycodone. This is a Schedule II controlled substance used for moderate to severe pain. The safety stakes here are much, much higher.
Much higher. Oxycodone is a potent opioid analgesic. Dynamically, it binds primarily and powerfully to mu opioid receptors in the CNS, which alters pain perception. This binding also causes widespread systemic effects, most importantly, CNS and respiratory depression, as well as decreased GI motility.
And the key adverse effects?
Sedation, pronounced constipation, orthostatic hypotension, and of course the high risks of tolerance, dependence, and addiction with prolonged use.
So the nursing safety focus here is intense and immediate. It demands acute clinical judgment.
It absolutely does. You must assess pain, respiratory rate, and level of sedation before and after dosing. We're talking about checking the rate, depth, and rhythm of respiration and using a sedation scale, like the Passero scale, every single time.
And if the patient's respiratory rate is less than 12 per minute?
Or they show excessive sedation, like they're hard to arouse, or falling asleep mid-sentence, you must hold the dose and notify the provider immediately.
The nurse is also responsible for managing the predictable side effects, like constipation.
Correct. Opioid-induced constipation is expected, and it's often debilitating, so you have to implement a proactive bowel regimen. Don't just wait for the patient to complain. This means prophylactic laxatives or stool softeners.
But the most critical consideration for acute safety
is ensuring that naloxone, or Narcan, is immediately available for overdose and that staff are trained to administer it. Naloxone is a high-affinity opioid antagonist that reverses the CNS and respiratory depression instantly.
Okay, moving on to GI medications. Let's cover common OTC relief first, like laxatives. Our sources categorize them broadly: osmotic, stimulant, bulk-forming, and emollients or stool softeners.
All providing different mechanisms for managing constipation. Let's focus on the osmotic type using polyethylene glycol or MiroLAX as our primary example. Its use is safe for occasional or chronic constipation.
And dynamically, how does it work?
It's largely non-absorbed and acts osmotically. It just draws water from the body into the intestinal lumen. This water influx softens the stool, increases its volume, and promotes peristalsis without directly stimulating the intestinal nerves.
Which is why its onset is slower than a stimulant laxative, correct?
Exactly. The onset is usually 1 to 3 days, which makes it totally inappropriate for immediate relief. AEs are generally mild bloating, flatulence, some abdominal cramping. And because it's largely non-absorbed and works primarily via osmosis, significant electrolyte imbalance is rare with standard use, making it safer for long-term management than many stimulant laxatives.
So what are the key NCs for teaching a patient how to use MiroLAX effectively?
Key NCs include instructing the patient to mix the powder fully with 4 to 8 ounces of liquid to ensure adequate dissolution and proper function. Secondly, emphasize the need for the patient to encourage adequate fluid intake throughout the day because the drug relies on external water for its osmotic effect. And crucially, you have to reinforce that they do not use it for immediate relief of an acute impaction. And caution should always be used if a bowel obstruction is suspected because increasing volume could be dangerous.
Conversely, for diarrhea or upset stomach, we have bismuth subsalicylate pepto-bismol. This agent acts as an antidiarrheal, antacid, and antisecretory agent.
Mm-hmm. Often used for acute or traveler's diarrhea and as an adjunct for H. pylori treatment.
And its dynamics are layered.
They are. The bismuth coats and protects the gastric mucosa and has mild antimicrobial activity against certain pathogens. The salicylate component, which is the active ingredient in aspirin, also reduces prostaglandin-mediated inflammation in the gut. Kinetically, the salicylate is partially absorbed systemically and excreted by the kidneys, while the bismuth is mostly excreted in feces.
The adverse effects here are pretty famous, but nurses have to understand the specific toxicity risk.
Right. The famous AEs are the harmless black stools and the temporary black tongue, which is caused by the bismuth reacting with sulfur compounds in the mouth and GI tract. So the critical nursing considerations are assessing the patient's hydration status during diarrhea and educating them that those color changes are expected and temporary.
But the salicylate component that introduces a high-stakes safety warning, particularly in pediatrics.
Yes. Because of that systemic salicylate absorption, it must be avoided in patients with known aspirin sensitivity. Most importantly, it is strictly avoided in children and adolescents with viral infections like the flu or chickenpox due to the risk of Reye's syndrome.
Which is a rare but severe condition causing swelling in the liver and brain.
A very severe condition. You also have to monitor all patients for signs of salicylate toxicity, like tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears, dizziness, and nausea. Those indicate excessive levels.
And briefly on other GI classes. Antacids, like Tums, are commonly used for immediate heartburn relief.
And teaching there focuses on the active ingredients, calcium, magnesium, aluminum, and the associated drug interaction risk. They often impair the absorption of crucial medications like iron supplements or some antibiotics due to altered pH or chelation.
So patients need to space doses appropriately.
They do. And for proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, like omeprazole, common uses include managing severe acid reflux and ulcers. Client teaching involves understanding the crucial timing of administration, often 30 to 60 minutes before the first meal of the day to maximize efficacy, and monitoring for adverse effects that come with prolonged acid suppression, like potential changes in nutrient absorption.
Okay, let's move up the body to respiratory treatments, specifically antihistamines, using diphenhydramine or Benadryl as our prototype. This is a first-generation H1 receptor antagonist.
But the defining feature of its dynamic profile is its strong anticholinergic activity. Diphenhydramine is highly lipophilic, which means it readily crosses the blood-brain barrier, and that causes significant central effects. It's used for acute allergic reactions, motion sickness, and often as a short-term sleep aid because of the sedation. Dynamically, it blocks H1 receptors and decreases capillary permeability and itching. But the anticholinergic effects are responsible for that wide range of systemic side effects.
And it's the adverse effects and contraindications that demand intense nursing focus, particularly in the elderly.
Absolutely. The AEs include pronounced sedation, dizziness, and the classic suite of anticholinergic effects. Dry mouth, blurred vision, urinary retention, and constipation. Clinically, in older adults, these effects can precipitate confusion, delirium, and a severe fall risk.
Which leads directly to a long list of contraindications.
It does. Specifically, it is strongly discouraged in older adults because it is listed on the Beers criteria as an inappropriate medication for geriatric use due to the risk of CNS and anticholinergic side effects.
It's also contraindicated in patients whose conditions are aggravated by anticholinergic effects.
Like those with glaucoma, due to increased intraocular pressure, BPH, or urinary retention, and caution is advised in patients with asthma or COPD because it thickens respiratory secretions, making them harder to clear. And critically, it absolutely cannot be combined with concurrent CNS depressants like alcohol or opioids.
Because of the heightened risk of respiratory depression and deep sedation?
Mm.
Therefore, the NCs revolve around safety and education.
Always assess alertness and fall risk before and after administration. Teach patients to avoid driving or operating machinery and strictly avoid alcohol and other sedatives. For long-term allergy control, the nurse has to advocate for the use of second-generation antihistamines like loratadine or cetirizine.
Because they typically don't cross the blood-brain barrier and cause significantly less sedation.
Far fewer anticholinergic effects.
A quick note on cough medications. Cough suppressants or antitussives, like those containing dextromethorphan, are used to quiet a dry, non-productive cough.
And the major cautions there are the potential for misuse, and if used with other drugs that increase serotonin, the rare but severe risk of serotonin syndrome, which is characterized by agitation, hyperthermia, and hyperreflexia.
And cough expectorants, like guaifenesin.
They're used to liquefy secretions and aid in clearing them from the respiratory tract. The teaching here is crucial. You must emphasize hydration as the primary requirement for expectorants to be effective. Without adequate water intake, the medication is just far less functional. And always caution against the potential for over-medicating, especially when combined with other cold products.
Finally, let's briefly touch on topical medications. Emollients, moisturizers are common OTC products used to manage dry skin.
And teaching there just focuses on proper application technique and ensuring the patient isn't using them over open wounds unless specified.
Then we have topical corticosteroids, often used for localized inflammation and itching, like hydrocortisone cream.
And nursing teaching must focus on the proper application technique, using the lowest effective dose for the shortest duration, and monitoring for possible complications like thinning of the skin or atrophy or systemic absorption if it's applied liberally over large surface areas or under occlusion.
Okay, we have to contrast the generalized precautions of OTCs with the intense, non-negotiable monitoring required for high alert prescriptions. Let's look at lisinopril, an angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE, inhibitor.
Lisinopril is a massive workhorse medication. It's used for hypertension, managing heart failure following a myocardial infarction, and significantly for managing diabetic nephropathy because of its renal protective effects.
Okay, let's break down its powerful dynamics.
So lisinopril inhibits the ACE enzyme. This enzyme usually converts angiotensin I into angiotensin II. By inhibiting this process, three things happen. One, angiotensin II levels decrease, which results in less vasoconstriction, leading to vasodilation and a lower blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Two, decreased angiotensin II leads to decreased aldosterone secretion, which results in decreased sodium and water retention. And three, crucially, ACE inhibition also prevents the breakdown of bradykinin, which is a potent vasodilator.
And it's the accumulation of that bradykinin that causes one of the most common and persistent adverse effects, isn't it?
Exactly. The key adverse effects include predictable hypotension, especially that first dose effect, a pervasive, dry, persistent, non-productive cough, which is caused by the increased bradykinin, hyperkalemia due to decreased aldosterone, and the risk of acute kidney injury, or AKI.
But the most critical, life-threatening adverse effect that elevates this to a high alert drug status is angioedema.
Angioedema is a rare but non-negotiable medical emergency. It's caused by an excessive accumulation of bradykinin in the subcutaneous tissues, and it presents as rapid, profound swelling of the face, lips, tongue, and throat. This can lead to rapid airway obstruction and death.
So what are the absolute contraindications?
Pregnancy, it is teratogenic, and a history of angioedema with any ACE inhibitor or angiotensin receptor blocker.
And finally, the essential nursing considerations for a patient on lisinopril. This is where your monitoring must be intense.
Intense monitoring is the standard. You have to check the client's blood pressure before every single administration. You cannot give this drug without a current BP reading. You must monitor renal function, BUN, and creatinine and potassium levels regularly because hyperkalemia and AKI are very real risks.
Mm-hmm.
You have to teach the patient to avoid potassium supplements and salt substitutes. Teach them to rise slowly to prevent orthostatic hypotension. But most importantly, teach the patient to report any signs of swelling around the mouth or throat. If angioedema occurs, it requires immediate discontinuation of the drug and emergency medical care, including immediate administration of epinephrine. That knowledge saves lives.
So what we've synthesized today is really the crucial link between the theoretical principles of pharmacology,
mm-hmm.
the PK and the PD, and the practical high-stakes responsibilities of the nurse.
Mm-hmm.
We moved through the regulatory structure of OTCs, the fundamentals of how drugs interact at the receptor level, what the body does to the drug with ADME, and how those kinetic and dynamic factors influence risk across a spectrum of common medications.
Yeah, from easily available NSAIDs to life-saving naloxone and intensely monitored ACE inhibitors.
The ultimate power of the nurse lies not just in accurately administering medication, but really in the teaching role.
Yes. Ensuring the client knows the proper selection, usage, contraindications, and when to seek professional help for conditions requiring prescription intervention. You have to anticipate the interactions, predict the variability, and proactively teach safety.
It's the difference between simply giving the pill and understanding the entire physiological pathway that pill takes and the potential life-saving interventions you have to be prepared to make.
Indeed. And considering the deep pharmacokinetic and dynamic interactions we discussed today, here is a final provocative thought for you, the learner. How might a nurse specifically counsel an elderly client who is taking multiple OTC medications like chronic high-dose acetaminophen for arthritis pain and diphenhydramine for occasional sleep. Given their likely reduced hepatic and renal function, their heightened susceptibility to anticholinergic effects, and their increased baseline fall risk.
Right. Think about combining those nursing considerations for maximum daily dosing, monitoring liver function, managing CNS depression, mitigating anticholinergic effects like urinary retention, and assessing that overall synergistic risk of a fall.
Mm.
That is true, integrated clinical judgment. And that is the power you now hold.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.